It's great to hear from Estelle this morning and her heart for college students and college ministry. If I had been connected with something like InterVarsity Christian Fellowship when I was a college student, my experience of college might have been a little bit different. As it was, when I returned from Christmas vacation during my senior year, I was shocked to receive this letter in my box coming from the advisor of the student publications, informing me that I would no longer be able to serve on the student publications because of insubordination. Turns out that four other journalism majors were also received that letter, and we were all outraged at this. Now, it's true that we were not particularly receptive to the student, the advisor of the student publications. We considered him sort of a incompetent lackey for the administration who was bent on restricting freedom of the press. So we didn't take very kindly to him. He was a new advisor, and there's lots of issues behind all of that, but we weren't receptive to him at all. But we were shocked when we received this letter. Dismissed without a hearing, insubordination, this was an outrage. Okay, so we were up in arms, and we decided we were going to take our case to the local media in Southern California. We alerted newspapers in the area of what was going on at Pepperdine. We were the firing of the Pepperdine Five, and we were not going to stand for this. And, of course, the media oftentimes is very interested in freedom of the press type issues, so they took up the story. And several newspapers in Southern California decided to run stories on our particular department and incident. And here is a front page from the Thousand Oaks News Chronicle, Wednesday, January 31st, 1979, headline, Pepperdine Department in Uproar, complete with a lot of photos, including a photo of me and two of my compatriots, which you can see right here. Well, that's funny. You like the hair, don't you? Well, you can see, here we are, locked out of the student publications department, and there I am with my angry young man pose, and I am not going to take any guff from anybody, so I am up in arms. There's a call to arms, and we're very upset about this whole situation. Well, today's text concerns rushing to judgment. The assumptions that we have when we often find ourselves in some sort of adversarial relationship, and then we rush to judgment, we tend to throw truth to the wind and make decisions just right at the beginning of things and jump to conclusions, and we throw truth to the wind and we rush to judgment. That's what the Israelites do anyway in our chapter today, Judges chapter 21 to 17. You can turn there if you like. It's on page 254 in the Pew Bibles. And as usual, the book of Judges is very good for us at identifying sin and sinful tendencies. However, it does not give us much help with our sinful tendencies in order to overcome them. For that, the book of Judges suggests perhaps that a king is coming. If everyone does right in his own eyes because there is no king in Israel, perhaps a king is coming in Israel. Perhaps a king is coming in this world who can help us with our sinful tendencies, and we will hear from that king this morning in addition to listening to the book of Judges. A little background before we begin in Judges chapter 20. Last week we looked at Judges chapter 19, one of the most disturbing chapters in all of the Bible. It featured this Levite and his concubine that would be a sexual partner. They were not married, but they had this relationship. The Levite, he was a man from the tribe of Levi. He goes to Gibeah with the concubine. And the men of Gibeah, or certain men of Gibeah anyway, in the town of Gibeah, which belonged to the tribe of Benjamin in Israel, certain men wanted to rape the Levite. However, the Levite, instead of offering himself to these men, he offers up his concubine. He throws his concubine to these wolfish men, and they rape her, and they rape her, and they rape her, and they abuse her, and they leave her for dead. And the Levite eventually picks up this woman, takes her back, and he is outraged by what has happened, and he cuts up his concubine into 12 pieces. He sends these pieces throughout the 12 tribes of Israel as a sort of call to arms to alert Israel that this outrage has happened and you should do something about it. So the question concerning how Israel responds to this outrage is the subject of Judges chapter 20. We'll be looking at the first 17 verses this morning. Judges chapter 20, verses 1 through 7. Then all the Israelites from Dan to Beersheba and from the land of Gilead came out as one man and assembled before the Lord in Mizpah. The leaders of all the people of the tribes of Israel took their places in the assembly of the people of God, 400,000 soldiers armed with swords. The Benjamites heard that the Israelites had gone up to Mizpah. Then the Israelites said, "Tell us how this awful thing happened." So the Levite, the husband of the murdered woman, said, "I and my concubine came to Gibeah in Benjamin to spend the night. During the night, the men of Gibeah came after me and surrounded the house, intending to kill me. They raped my concubine, and she died. I took my concubine, cut her into pieces, and sent one piece to each region of Israel's inheritance because they committed this lewd and disgraceful act in Israel. Now, all you Israelites, speak up and give your verdict." So all Israel gathers to this one particular city, Mizpah, from Dan to Beersheba, Dan in the north to Beersheba in the south, even including the land of Gilead, which was east of the Jordan River, and the people east of the Jordan River had a testy relationship with those who were west of the Jordan. So all Israel now is coming together to hear this particular case. Literally, they gather as one man or as one person. And this Levite is able to do what none of the other judges was able to do throughout the book of Judges: unite Israel. So this Levite is able to do that. This would be a promising development. This unity would be a promising development if it were not for the presence of 400,000 soldiers. And these 400,000 soldiers already put the men of Gibeah on the defensive and make war all but inevitable. Now the Israelites ask, how has this awful thing happened? How could such a thing take place? How could this rape take place? And how could the resulting cutting of this woman in 12 pieces, how does this awful thing happen? If the narrator himself were to answer the question, he would say, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his or her own eyes. The Levite comes forward with his testimony, and his testimony is filled with half-truths and distortions. For example, he neglects to tell them that he himself is the one who threw the woman to these wolfish men. He doesn't say that. He conceals that information because, of course, that would be damaging to his case. In the first case, the Levite was willing to sacrifice his woman in order to protect his own hide, and now he is willing to sacrifice however many Israelite soldiers are necessary for the sake of personal revenge. Now, it's easy for us to sit in judgment of the Levite, and well, we should. However, think about the times you covet a particular outcome. Aren't you inclined in such cases maybe just a little bit to stretch the truth? Might you, if you want a certain outcome, withhold certain facts that might be damaging to your case? Might you embellish your record just a little bit? And might you even demonize the record of your opponent? The Levite was willing to sacrifice however many men necessary for the sake of personal revenge. What might we be inclined to sacrifice, and for what cause? Now, what the Levite did seems to me to be a recipe for how to run a modern political campaign in the United States of America. What do our politicians do, by and large, in order to get elected? They stretch the truth. They withhold any sort of information that would be damaging to their own cause, any kind of thing that would shed light on personal weaknesses. They don't tell you about that, of course. And oftentimes, they embellish their own records and they demonize their opponents. Many of them are willing to sacrifice certain things or certain people for the cause of getting elected. The sad truth in this is, if they didn't do this, if they didn't run their campaigns in this particular way, we would not vote for them. We wouldn't elect them. We know how the game works now. The game does not work with truth. The game works with distortion of truth. The game works with marketing, emphasizing a particular strength and diminishing weaknesses, or not even talking at all about your weaknesses. You can't say anything good about your opponent. You can't say anything bad about yourself. One of John McCain's gaffes in the last presidential election was admitting that the economy was not his strong suit. Now, if that's true, you can't say that. We won't let you say that. We won't vote for you if you say that. I'm sure many of you voted for John McCain, but that's going to torpedo his campaign because that's not the way the campaign is run these days, because every weakness will be exploited because we're not dealing with the truth. So if our leaders are bent on fudging the truth, is it any wonder that we do the same thing? Is it any wonder that we tend to stretch the truth and fudge the truth in order to secure a certain outcome that we covet? Well, the Israelites have listened to this Levite, and now they challenge the men of Gibeah, Judges chapter 20, verse 8. All the people rose as one man, saying, "None of us will go home. No, not one of us will return to his house. But now this is what we'll do to Gibeah. We'll go up against it as the lot directs. We'll take 10 men out of every 100 from all the tribes of Israel, and 100 from 1,000, and 1,000 from 10,000 to get provisions for the army. Then, when the army arrives at Gibeah in Benjamin, it can give them what they deserve for all this vileness done in Israel." So all the men of Israel got together and united as one man against the city. So the Israelites believe the lying Levite, and they mobilize in order to challenge the men of Gibeah. They mobilize literally as one man. Now, the judges throughout the book of Israel, occasionally they are able to mobilize certain people, and usually, but they are not able to mobilize all of Israel, and usually they are mobilizing people to take on the pagans. Here, all of Israel unites because of this lying Levite to take on not the pagans, but their own people. They seem to be more intent on taking the war to their own people than they do to the pagans. And are all these soldiers really necessary? Do you need 400,000 soldiers plus 10% of every man to man the supply lines? Is this really necessary? Isn't this a little bit of an overkill? And what about trying diplomacy before marching on the men of Gibeah? And who can stop the march toward war once men hear the drums beating? Think about your own experience with wrongdoing. Doesn't oftentimes the blood start boiling? That's probably right. Yeah, there should be a certain outrage. We should be outraged at this rape and everything that has happened around it. But think about the times that your blood starts boiling. Don't you tend to jump to conclusions and shut out other testimony? I don't want to hear anything else. I've already made my mind up. I'm not going to listen to anybody else. We tend to jump to instant conclusions. We might think of Caiaphas, the high priest, during the time of Jesus. He has Jesus before him, and he's asking, he's questioning all these people. He finally has Jesus, and he asks him a question or two. And after Jesus answered, Caiaphas says, "Why do we need any more witnesses?" In point of fact, he needed a lot more witnesses. He needed to listen to a lot more than to the witnesses he had already heard. And don't we tend to, like the Israelites, overreact? The Israelites in the day of Jesus also overreacted. Caiaphas says to the rest of the council, the Sanhedrin, the ruling council in the land of Jerusalem, "What do you think regarding Jesus?" How did they answer? "He is worthy of death." Death. Isn't that a little extreme? And once we tend to identify who the opponents are, others who are associated with those opponents often become guilty by association. That's what happened in the land of Israel back in the day of the judges. Others is not just the rapists, others who associated with them, all of Gibeah, all of Benjamin, all of them became guilty by association. We as followers of Jesus Christ, when we are involved in adversarial relationships, we are called to listen, and to listen longer. This is difficult, but this is what we are called to do, to listen longer, to listen and to consider more than one side of the story so that we can get the whole story, and to suspend judgment until all of the facts are in. Listen. Listen. It's very simple, but it is also very difficult. Especially, watch for the times when your blood starts boiling and the drums start beating. Because when that happens, oftentimes the truth gets drowned out. You can't hear it. You can't hear the truth because you've shut off your ears and you're not listening. At such times, it's very easy then to believe lies. To believe lies and then to mobilize for the wrong cause. When I was a reporter, yes, I survived my dismissal in college to go on to be a reporter. Actually earned a paycheck for then supposed to being volunteering in the student publications. So I was a journalism major. I went on to become a reporter. And then as a reporter, what is your job? It's to get the story. What do you have to do? You have to listen. You have to listen to both sides, or you have to listen to all sides. And so I learned to listen for as long as necessary in order to get the story. But it's easy to do that when it's your job, number one, and number two, when you don't have a stake in the matter. It really didn't matter to me so much who was right and who was wrong. I really had to get the story. I had to listen to both sides in order to report the story in an accurate and compelling way. Oftentimes, in fact, it was a story because the two sides weren't listening to one another. If two people don't listen to one another, it's a conflict. People become interested. It becomes a story. So when you are involved in all of this, it becomes very difficult to actually listen to the other side. Nevertheless, this is what we must strive for as followers of Jesus Christ. Listen to the other side. And why is it, especially in the church, that we have difficulty listening to one another? Could it be that we have a spiritual adversary who is out to get us, who is out to turn us against one another in order to distract us from the task at hand, which is to worship the Lord and to bring His healing love to the world? We get distracted, I think, by the evil one who turns us against one another so that we will forget about him, so that we will forget about evil, so that all we'll do is we'll see evil in the church. All we'll do is see evil in one another instead of worshiping the Lord and bringing His healing love to the world. So we end up fighting each other instead of fighting evil. And oftentimes, some of these differences revolve around theological issues. But oftentimes when that happens, the theological issue isn't the real thing. It's personal animosity that is the real thing. It is personal animosity that is underneath all of this, and the theological issue is the cover for the personal animosity. For example, it is much easier to say, oh, what I'm doing is standing up for the truth. That's why I'm so passionate about this. But really, underneath the whole thing, you're really angry. You're angry at the other person, and personal animosity is out of control. And the theological issue is just a cover, oftentimes, for personal animosity. I heard from a scholar one time, or I read about a scholar one time, who was responding to a book that was written against a position of his, and he was asked, are you going to write a book against the person who wrote the book against you? And his response was this, I'd rather be fighting the pagans, by which I presume he meant pagan ideas. So that's the task at hand, is to fight the pagan ideas by bringing the love of God to the world. Now, in the book of Judges here in Judges chapter 20, the phrase one person or one man is repeated on multiple occasions. One person, one man, they gather as one person. We can say this is a good thing. In fact, Jesus died on the cross for our sins, according to Paul in Ephesians chapter 2, verse 15, to create literally one new person, one new man, one new humanity, so that together we would worship the Lord and bring His healing love to the world. And if necessary, on certain occasions, discipline someone among us who has willfully sinned and refuses to repent, as long as we do so with humility and love in order to win back our wayward brother. The Israelites now back the Benjamites into a corner. Judges chapter 20, verse 12. The tribes of Israel sent men throughout the tribe of Benjamin, saying, what about this awful crime that was committed among you? Now surrender those wicked men of Gibeah so that we may put them to death and purge the evil from Israel. But the Benjamites would not listen to their fellow Israelites. From their towns, they came together at Gibeah to fight against the Israelites. At once, the Benjamites mobilized 26,000 swordsmen from their towns, in addition to 700 chosen men from those living in Gibeah. Among all these soldiers, there were 700 chosen men who were left-handed, each of whom could sling a stone at a hair and not miss. Israel, apart from Benjamin, mustered 400,000 swordsmen, all of them fighting men. So the Israelites isolate the tribe of Benjamin, they level these accusations against the tribe of Benjamin, and they demand that the Benjamites hand over the wrongdoers. They are ostensibly interested in purging this evil from Israel. However, they do not notice the evil in the slimy Levite who first of all told them about all of this. They can't see that. They can't see the obvious evil. And they can't see the evil in their own response to this particular issue. They can't see their own issues. All they're concerned with is looking about out there. Yes, it's an outrageous thing that has happened, but they can't see the outrageous things that they themselves are doing. Not surprisingly then, the Benjamites mobilize for war. And it would seem as if the Israelites have this overwhelming advantage. They outnumber the Benjamites 15-1. However, the narrator notes that the tribe of Benjamin includes 700 elite warriors, so perhaps we think the tribe of Benjamin has a puncher's chance. And we will see what happens in this whole war that ensues next week in the rest of Judges chapter 20. When we back people into a corner with our accusations and our demands, we give them little choice but to fight back. Are we missing something? What is it? What is it that we're missing? What is it that we can't see? Jesus Christ is the king who was to come from the perspective of the book of Judges. He is the one necessary thing. He is the human and divine king. We submit to him. We do what is right in God's eyes, not in our own eyes. Let's listen to him. Famously, he says in Matthew chapter 7, verses 4 and 5, "How can you say to your brother, 'Let me take the speck out of your eye,' when all the time there was a plank in your own eye? You hypocrite. First, take the plank out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's eye." Two problems, Jesus says. First of all, you don't notice the obvious. You don't notice the plank in your own eye. Second problem, with a plank in your own eye, you can't see what you're doing. And that was the problem of the Israelites. They couldn't see what they were doing. They had a plank in their own eye, so they couldn't really see what was going on. They couldn't see what needed to be done. They couldn't listen to the Benjamites. Now, Jesus here is not denying a place for removing specks from our brother's eyes, of course. He's not denying a place for that, nor, of course, is he denying a place for punishing rapists. But he is saying this: before you do that, before you remove the speck, before you punish the rapist, before you prosecute your case, before you make any sorts of allegations or try to work things out at all, before you do that, what you need to do is look in the mirror. Look in the mirror. And if you look in the mirror, you can see the problem perhaps with yourself, and then you can see clearly. So looking in the mirror, what is that going to do? That's going to purify our hearts and clarify our vision for the task at hand. Look in the mirror. Now, when I was a boy, I had a betta, which is a Siamese fighting fish. Now, if you're going to get one of these, you've got to make sure you get a male. Nothing against the females. Nothing against females in general, of course. I married one 12 years ago. But if you're talking about the female of the betta species, they're not nearly as beautiful as the males. And so here is a picture of one of the males. And one of the interesting things to do, or I enjoyed doing this as a child, I would put a mirror in front of my betta. Now, maybe some of you have tried this. Do you know what happens when you put a mirror in front of a betta? It thinks it's looking at another male. What do Siamese fighting fish do? They fight. So they get all flared up and they think they're taking on a male. So that's a picture of a flared up betta thinking that he's taking on another male. But what's the problem in this particular illustration? The problem is the fish itself. The problem is himself. He's getting all flared up, but really what he should do is get flared up at himself, so to speak. He should take on his own issues before he deals with the issue with the other Siamese fighting fish, before he goes to battle, so to speak, before he rumbles against the other opponent. Now, there is certainly a place for us as the Church of Jesus Christ to speak in the public square. We have a lot to say. Our world needs to hear what we say. But too often, I think, we are perceived to be people who are hypocrites, who are thundering from on high, who are not really listening to anyone else. Now, perhaps this is inevitable in a particular society which we inhabit right now, in which there's much division and where you are immediately labeled and categorized based on whatever position you hold. So oftentimes, if you hold a particular position or you think certain things, you are immediately assumed to be a hater. In some quarters, by the way. Not all, but in some quarters, that's what happens. So perhaps such things are inevitable. Nevertheless, that is no excuse for us not to listen. There's no excuse for us not to look in the mirror. That's what we need to do. Perhaps we will gain a hearing if we are intent on looking in the mirror and listening. I'm impressed, by the way, from what I see from the Community Pregnancy Center in our area, especially our very own Peg Young. And if you listen to Peg, when she is counseling someone who is intent on getting an abortion, she listens very carefully to that particular woman, all the pain that is in her heart, everything that is bringing her to make this particular decision. So that's what we need to do. We need to listen, and listen hard before we speak. So now in retrospect, I can see that when I was in college, I rushed to judgment. The hindsight of years and my involvement with the people of God and the scriptures over all these years, and in fact, it wasn't that many years later when I started to realize that maybe I was in error back then, and now I can say, yes, I was in error. I rushed to judgment. The blood was boiling, the drums were beating, and my fins were flaring. I was an angry young man. Now I can see the advisor was mostly right, and I was mostly wrong. Instead of rushing to judgment, I should have looked in the mirror. And if I had looked in the mirror, what I would have seen is a lot of youthful arrogance. I would have seen that. I look at this picture now. Yeah, sure, I was posing a little bit. I was supposed to look a little bit angry, fold my hands. But if I look into my eyes, and I know what's going on in my heart, there was a lot of arrogance. There was a lot of anger. And I couldn't see that at the time. But now, I can see it. I've been involved with the scriptures. The Holy Spirit has ministered to me. I've been involved with you, the people of God. All of this has had a positive effect on me so that I'm more inclined now to see the truth of what was going on back then. Instead of rushing to judgment, I should have listened to the advisor. He spoke, to be sure, but I couldn't hear him. If I had listened to him, I would have heard from a man who was doing the best he could do to do a very difficult job under difficult circumstances, some of which I helped to create. I would have heard that. I would have heard his heart if I actually had listened to him, but I had no interest in listening to him or understanding his heart at all. And today I resonate with the poem of Yeats titled "The Coming of Wisdom with Time." It goes like this. Though leaves are many, the root is one. Through all the lying days of my youth, I swayed my leaves and flowers in the sun. Now I may wither into the truth.